The reason that we're here this morning is for this word gospel. And this gospel is a Greek word that means good news. I don't know about you, but I need good news this morning. And we talk about that word a lot, gospel, gospel. And my dad was meeting with a Chinese scholar, and he asked him, what do those Chinese symbols mean for gospel? And he says, oh, those words mean the voice of happiness. And I just love that, that just hit it at a different angle, like, wow, the gospel is the voice of happiness. So I hope that this morning you will hear the voice of happiness. Now, we're going to take kind of a strange way to get there in a very difficult passage, difficult for us to hear. But here's where we're going this morning. The reason that this is a voice of happiness is because this whole book is about God restoring this broken world. That's what his whole mission is about. It starts in a perfect Garden of Eden, and it ends with heaven. But in between, we've got this broken world, but it begins and ends with a paradise. Now, here's what that's going to take. For God to restore paradise, it's going to take drastic measures. Here's the big idea this morning. For the world to be restored, God must be put back in charge. For the world to be restored, God must be put back in charge. Now, here's the context. If you have a Bible, open to Deuteronomy 7 or turn it on the Veritas app. You can open the scriptures to Deuteronomy 7 or any Bible app that you have. Here's the context of Deuteronomy, the book we're studying through this summer. Israel had spent over 400 years in slavery and 40 years in the wilderness, in the desert, and now they are on the verge of going into this land that they have been waiting for hundreds and hundreds of years. They're about to go into the promised land. With that context, I want to read Deuteronomy 7. It says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. All right, welcome to Veritas Church. Glad you're here this morning. It's funny, this is Father's Day, and I was actually, sometimes I listen to soundtracks when I'm preparing a sermon, and I had the Braveheart soundtrack on, and I'm like, it's Father's Day, we're going Braveheart this morning. But here's the first point. I want you to write this down. Restoration, it requires a drastic measure, but it requires a world without idols. Restoration. If God's going to take back his good earth that he created, it's going to require a world without idols. The goodness of God and idols cannot coexist. Here's the problem we see in this text. Canaan is to idols what Dunkin' Donuts is to donuts, right? That's what they make there. Canaan is filled with idols. Look at verse 5. He says, break them down, smash their sacred stones. These sacred stones were large stone pillars. They were basically massive phallic symbols. Parents, I'll leave you to explain that later to your kids. And these huge stones represented the god, one of their gods, Baal. Baal was the Lord of the Canaanite gods. Now, he says, Moses says you've got to cut down these Asherah poles and burn them. So these were carved wooden images of the goddess Asherah. Now every April, these gods would be intimate and the land would become fertile again. And so you can imagine how they would worship these gods of fertility. What better way to worship than to go into their temple and imitate their behavior? The temples were filled with male and female prostitutes. So in Canaan, perversion was not just tolerated. I mean, think about how far we've come from Genesis 1. God made them male and female for this reason. He will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Think about how far we've deviated from God's original design. And this perversion was not just tolerated. It's not just like, that's okay. It's like, no, that's encouraged. Right? When you go into Dunkin' Donuts, it's not just okay that you eat donuts. It's like, eat your fill. Right? That's why you're here. That's what Canaan was like. Okay, eating donuts is not the same as going into the temple. Okay, whatever. But I'm just saying, that's like, it wasn't weird, right? It wasn't strange because that's what Canaan was like. That's the environment that God's people are about to step into. And in verse 3, he says this, do not intermarry with them. Do not intermarry with them. Now, to understand this was like there was a political aspect here to the intermarriage. Basically, you would marry someone almost of a different ethnicity or different people group. It was almost like a treaty, right? Because we're at war with each other, and if I marry you, families don't fight, do they? So let's just marry the enemy, and then we'll be good. We'll have peace because now we're related. So it's kind of this idea of, like, if you can't beat them, marry them, right? So we're going to rely on God saying, no, I want you to go in there and destroy them totally because I don't want you to rely on their power to get the promised land. But it's not just a political aspect to this. There's also a social aspect. I want you to think about this. Imagine being a Jewish woman going into Canaan. Okay, going into this place where all of these gods are worshipped. They've got gods for the stars and the sun and the moon and fertility gods and all this stuff. You're this Jewish woman and you marry a Canaanite man. How's that going to go for you? You have completely different purposes in life, right? You're living for completely different things, and yet you're coming together in the most intimate relationship. And so what we have here is, you know, a mom saying, teaching the children, you know, the Ten Commandments. And while mom is quoting the Ten Commands, dad is breaking them all, right? You shall have no other gods. He's like, we've got tons of gods. You shall not commit adultery. Let's go to the temple, right? And if you're the child growing up in that situation, which one are you going to go for? Probably going to the temple to worship Baal and Asherah. So God is saying, you need to go in and you need to eliminate idolatry. Now there's tension here. There's tension. Because in Genesis 12, God says, I'm going to bless all the nations through you. And now Deuteronomy 7 is saying, I'm going to destroy the nations through you. How do these things come together? How can God command them to wipe these people out? Well, we go on and look at verse 6. Here's his reason. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you are the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your ancestors that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Here's the second point. God is committed to restoring this earth. It's going to require him being put back in charge, but that's going to require, number two, a people belonging to him. For restoration to happen on earth, there has to be a people that belong to God. Look at verse 6. He says, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God." Think about these people, this people that God has chosen, these Israelites. They are set apart. They're holy. They're pure. He says they're chosen. Of all the people on earth, God picked this little tribe, Israel. Verse 8, we see that they are loved. They are redeemed. They've been bought out of slavery. Verse 13 and 14, he says that these people are blessed. We've got a people that are holy, chosen, loved, redeemed, blessed. And in verse 6, this kind of summarizes all of those things. He says, they are my treasured possession. In these times, the king would own everything, all the land, all the people. But the king still had personal, private property, his special possessions. That's what God's saying is true of his people. I own everything, but these people are my treasured possession. Let me ask you a question. What do you own that you treasure? Kids, children who are here this morning, children, what do you own that you treasure? When I was your age, you know what I treasured? I treasured my blue tractor. I had a blue tractor. I called it a roof tractor. It was like a tractor with a cab on it, and it had the dualies on the back, and it could pull the big plows. And my grandpa was a farmer, and I thought this represents something powerful. I had this blue tractor, and I wondered why it wasn't green. Now I know it's because my parents were so cheap. And so I had this blue tractor, and I'm playing with this toy, and I loved this tractor. I played with it all the time. Now imagine I'm playing with this toy tractor, and all of a sudden I hear a little voice. This tractor that I love, this tractor that I own, and this little voice says, "I don't like you." I'm like, "What? I think that came from the tractor." I know. It's not going to speak back to me. Like, I own that. It's mine. It belongs to me. That's kind of the picture here. It's this picture of ownership, but don't miss the contrast here. Think about what we read in the first 5 verses. How serious God is about eliminating idolatry. But then think about verses 6 through 8. He's like, eliminate all these idols because you are my people. And then he explains in verse 8, he says, I brought you out of Egypt from the power of Pharaoh. He's saying, remember what life was like in Egypt. Remember how slavery to Pharaoh stole away your humanity. Remember how Pharaoh and his idols made you slaves, made you objects. That's what idolatry does, is it makes you a slave. And he's like, the promised land will not be slavery 2.0. We cannot do that again. He says, as we've been talking about for the last few weeks, command number 0 in the 10 commandments, you remember what it is. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of that land of slavery and bondage. Command number 1, you shall have no other gods before me. Why is God so ruthless in eliminating idolatry? It's because the promised land is about living as a son, not as a slave. And in my house, there are two things that would be incompatible. My children cannot live as slaves. Those two things cannot go together. In my home, you're only one of my children, okay? That's what it's like being in my home. And God knows if they go into the land and they go down that path of idolatry, it's just going to be Egypt 2.0. It's just going to be slavery again. But as we see, it's even more intimate than being a child, right? You're not just a toy that God plays with. You're not just a big blue tractor in God's hands. You're not even just a child in God's house. If we zoom out and we see the story, it's that you are the very bride of Christ. The most intimate of relationships. You are the bride of Christ. We see this is how the story ends. And think about what a married couple does. They say things like, to you alone do I give my eyes and my body, my mind and my body. It's yours. It belongs to you. We belong to each other. Imagine going on your honeymoon and your fiance is like, you bought 10 tickets to our honeymoon? We don't need 10 tickets. And you're like, oh yeah. Well, two for us, but then I have 8 other girlfriends that I'm bringing along. What? Those things don't go together, do they? This is why you have to understand, that is why God hates. That's why he forbids not just idolatry, but syncretism. Look at what we learned last week in Deuteronomy 6. He says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is what? The Lord is one." He said before, he's a jealous God. He's not going to share your affections with others. So when we go into Canaan, the reason we've got to eliminate their idols is because the reason we can't just add Yahweh, add God to Asherah and Hadad and Baal is because there's only one God. You cannot share God. He can't be shared. We see this in our culture all the time. We hear this constantly, do we not? All paths lead to God. Doesn't matter where you worship, how you worship. Don't be so narrow-minded. Right? All religions are equally valid, equally true. To say anything else is almost like hate language. Right? You guys, we are confronted in Deuteronomy with the one true God. He will not share his glory with other idols. Why not? Because he refuses to let his children live as slaves. Church, we live in Canaan, don't we? We could come up with 1,000 examples from just this past week of swapping stories about, oh yeah, this is what life is like in Canaan. America, I guarantee, America is just as good at making idols as Canaan was at making idols. I was thinking about this. We see in Deuteronomy 7, this is like a holy war. And that's hard for us because we have associations with like black flags and ISIS and holy wars and jihad. We all know that that's, no. It's like the epitome of evil. And yet, how do we see it in Deuteronomy 7? What's this all about? How do we think about this? You guys, this happened once. When you see the context in the scope of God's story, this was God's people. This was God's nation. God was making a country where he was God. It's called a theocracy. God, this was going to be a nation ruled by God. Church, we are not today in a holy war. We're not in this, we're not going to be culture warriors. We're not going to go fight a holy war. God is not calling us to a holy war. He's calling us to holy lives. I was thinking about this in 1 Corinthians 6. Paul says, hey, church, the reason that you can't be sexually immoral, the reason that you can't just give in to the idols of sex in America, in our culture, is because, in 1 Corinthians 6, he says, because you are not your own. You were bought at a price. The Israelites were brought out of Egypt, and that's Paul's argument for why we should be pure, we should not swear, we should not gossip, we should not steal, is because Jesus bought me with his blood, and we live as children of the King. And so, like Israel, we're loved, we're redeemed, we're called to this kind of a life. Look at in chapter 7 toward the end, in verse 25. Listen to what Moses says. The images of their gods you are to burn in the fire. Do not covet the silver and gold on them. Do not take it for yourselves, or you will be ensnared by it, for it is detestable to the Lord your God. Think about this. How hard would it be as you're smashing those stones, as you're burning the wood, to see a bunch of gold and silver that had been on the exterior of the idol? How tempting, God saying, smash it, burn it, melt it, get rid of it. If you're like me, I'd be like, ooh, we could take that. We could use that. That would be good for the Grow campaign. We've got a building that's going to be going up, and we could use that silver and that gold. And so we start to, and God's saying, get rid of it completely. I thought about what Jesus says. You cannot serve both God and money. God knows that the Israelites are going to be drawn away by the riches of Canaan. But look at verse 26. He says, so do not bring a detestable thing into your house, or you, like it, will be set apart for destruction. And I was confronted by, what am I bringing into my home? What am I allowing onto my screens? God is at war with idolatry. Are you? He says, for you are a people. Jesus says, if the salt loses its saltiness, what good is it? If you're putting salt on your food and it has no flavor, you can't taste this, it has no power. What? Just throw the salt away. It's no good. That's what Jesus said. If my people are living in Canaan, but they're no different, the people who say they're following me have no real desire to follow me, like, what good are they? Like, we are confronted this morning by the God who says, you are a people. That's why. Look at Deuteronomy in chapter 7, verses 9 through 10. He says, know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments. But those who hate him, he will repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate him. For those of you that are still not content with this explanation of why would God eliminate these idols and these people, there's actually more history here that we're going to get into in Deuteronomy 9. We're going to see that over 400 years, God had been pursuing these Canaanites and tolerating their wickedness. I mean, we think 12 years of the Third Reich was hard. Imagine 400 plus years, okay? God has borne with these people, his enemies, for years, pursuing them with mercy and grace. And yet he says in verse 10, but I will pay back to each, I will pay back, repay to their face. What does that mean? I'm going to repay you to your face. That's kind of an adversarial, angry thing to, you would say that out of anger to someone. What that means is I'm going to pay back each one individually. Every person is going to give an individual account to God. Hebrews 9 says this, it is appointed for man to die once and after that to face judgment. That's what we see here. Every single person is going to stand before God and give an account. But listen, guess what happens when Israel steps into the promised land? What's the very first story that happens? Remember the walls of Jericho come tumbling down? And guess what happens? God rescues a prostitute named Rahab. Of all of these wicked people living in Canaan, there's one prostitute who fears God. And she gets saved from the destruction. And she is actually in the lineage of Jesus. Rahab, this Canaanite prostitute, becomes Jesus' great, 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 great grandmother, right? Here's what I want to say, church. You have no idea how much God loves you. And the issue in Deuteronomy 7 is not, why does God destroy them? The question we are confronted with is, why does God not destroy me? Because I have way more in common with the people of Canaan than I do the holy God of Israel. I know it's true this week that I've gone into the temple, right, as it were. I've allowed myself to put other things over God. And the problem is, and I think there's a crisis in the church, is if we treat sin like a small thing. Because we have such a low view of God. We don't see our sin as an attack on the perfection and the holiness and the beauty of the Creator God. We don't see God for who He is. We don't see ourselves for who we are. And we see in this passage that God is way more loving than we could ever know. But our sin grieves Him more than we could ever imagine. So we see here in verse 9 and 10, it's almost like whiplash. God loves you. He's chosen you. He's redeemed you. But He is just. He will not let the guilty go unpunished. How do we reconcile these two things? If you just decide to settle for a God who is only loving, and He would never punish anyone except the really, really bad people like Hitler, and everyone else is just God loves, and you reject His holiness and His justice, you're not worshiping the one true God. Conversely, if you have a God who is always angry and He's only wrath, and He makes you just dress a certain way and sing a certain way and only drink, not drink certain beverages, and you live your life in fear of a God, and He's not really love, and He is more like the God of the black flag than the God who gave His blood for all the nations. You also are not worshiping the one true God of the Bible. We have to bring these things together. Let me explain how it helps me think about this. Okay, so I've got a friend in Omaha. We'll call him Chris. Chris served in the military. He is a first responder. I have a ton of respect for Chris. He has given his life to law enforcing the law, law and order, saving lives. Tons of respect for anyone in the crowd that's a first responder. Served our military. Awesome man. Well, here's the thing you need to know about Chris. He owns a house. And in his house, he also owns guns. And not only does he own guns, he owns a Doberman Pinscher, right? So he has a wife, and he just had a little girl. I want you to imagine, and he's got friends. I'm Chris's friend. I want you to imagine, I'm running for my life because I'm being attacked by somebody. And I'm running to Chris's house. I'm like, I got to get to Chris's house. Got to get to Chris's house. So I'm running. And Chris looks out the door, looks out the window, and he sees me running for my life from this enemy. And I run into his house. Guess what I experience? For me, I'm a friend. I'm Chris's friend. Me and his wife and his little girl experience the love of Chris. We experience his home as a refuge. But the enemy, what does he experience of Chris? His justice and his wrath and his anger against anyone who would attack himself or the people he loves. Let me ask you the question. In that one act of Chris defending his home and the people he loves, and taking out the enemy, what is he? Is Chris loving? Or is he just? How can he be both? Well, it depends on which side of Chris you're on. Whether you will experience his love and his grace, or his justice and his wrath. Which side of God are you on this morning? Because all of us have this in common: we will all die, and we will all stand before the Creator God. And if God does not defend his holiness and his people, he is not a God worth worshiping. If I run into Chris's house and I'm not safe because he will not defend me or those he loves, I mean, this is the God of the Bible. We are confronted with a God of love and justice and holiness. So, for our world to be restored, God's got to be put back in charge. That's going to require a world without idols. It's going to require a people belonging to God. And finally, it's going to require a city with foundations. I want you to think about this. A city with foundations. Look at Hebrews 11. I just want to read this quickly. It says, Abraham was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. It's talking about these Old Testament characters, and it says in verse 13, all these people, they were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. Instead, listen, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You guys, I hate to spoil the end of the story, but the Israelites go into the land. They get the land, and guess what happens? That's what all of this is about. The land is overtaken by idols. They give in. They worship the Canaanite gods. They fail miserably. The promised land ends up being just as broken as the Canaanite land. And it's like the story is reaching its climax, and in walks God himself, Yeshua, Jesus, God to the rescue. That's what his name means. And he steps in and he says, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. For those of you that might be afraid of God or put off by God, I promise you, if you could meet Jesus, you would love him, because he is the perfect expression of love and truth, of justice and mercy. And he has prepared a city for those who have trusted him, who have been redeemed and forgiven. I want to just invite you this morning, if you have never trusted Jesus and you're not sure which side of God you are on, run to Jesus and be saved. You need to take refuge from God in God. You need to take refuge from the holiness of God in the wounds of Jesus Christ. And if you will receive him, if you will just say his name, Jesus, you will be saved. And if you have received that gift, I don't know about you, but I long for this kingdom. I long for this home. We are not home yet. Church, we're not trying to set up the promised land on earth, okay? If you're like me, your heart is longing for home, because this world is broken, I'm broken. And yet we're called out. I just want to end this way, because I want to tell you about the city that God has prepared. The way I want you to do this is, I'm just going to have you close your eyes. Usually we look at the screens and we read along, but this is going to require your imagination. As I read, worship team, you guys coming up, and we're just going to end thinking about Revelation 21. This is how the story ends. This is the promised land where God gets rid of idolatry once and for all. This is the promised land where God's people are perfectly in relationship with him. This is the city with foundations. Listen, Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling place of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. He who overcomes will inherit all of this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be in the lake, the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Jesus, we say, come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. We long for you.